Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Toward the end of the show, we're going to be speaking with Nancy Hopkins Riley about her new book, Georgia O'Keeffe, A Private Friendship. Right now, I would like to welcome poet and writer Miriam Sagan. She has a new book called Gossip, published by Tres Chicas Books. Welcome.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you. And you will be speaking tonight at Collected Works Bookstore at 5:30.
Indeed.
Introducing the book, reading from it, and gossiping?
Well, more like signing.
Signing. Yeah. Right. This is a collection of personal essays. Where do you situate the personal essay in this day of memoir, autobiography, creative nonfiction?
You know, it's interesting because I think it's really the oldest of the forms in a certain way, and it's certainly the smallest. It's kind of ephemeral. And I sort of feel like an antiquer's attachment to it. You know, I search for it, I like it when I find it, and I'm trying to preserve it in a certain sense. I think it's not just these other literary forms that have supplanted it to some extent, but the sort of tell-all, confessional media take on individual experience. And the personal essay kind of it makes a nice little container. It's like a little teacup.
So it's not tell-all because it's just too short.
Exactly.
It's tell a little bit.
Tell a little bit.
Does that make it more tantalizing?
It makes it more handleable in terms of your issue as a writer. You know, how much am I going to tell? 800 words is going to limit it. And it is a little bit of a teaser in a way. Yeah.
Now, were all of these written originally for the newspaper? You said in the introduction you were talking about the Sage magazine of the Albuquerque Journal.
90% of them were written for two different editors at Sage. And they were just written over, you know, I was writing them, and I still am, about one a month, maybe 8 or 9 times a year. And so there's a lot of them. And they were not all up to the standard of being put in a book. But it was a great practice. It was almost like reading an old journal. I could go back and see everything that was on my mind over a 10-year period.
Well, it is for you. It's an opportunity to take what's on your mind and make an essay out of it, perhaps at the expense of your friends and family.
Well, that is always the issue, you know, in memoir, which is to say, did people really want to be close to you so they could become characters? And the answer is probably no, they did not. You know, I think I have a bad reputation of spilling the beans on other people, but I do want to say in my own self-defense that although these seem, you know, pretty vulnerable and honest, they were cautiously edited about certain things. I really almost stopped writing about my daughter once she became a teenager, even though there is a sort of daughter and boyfriend. But just the feeling of, like, you know, that even though my gossip level had gone wild on it, I didn't think it was appropriate. And I do, as a rule, check with most people who appear in it and let them see themselves, although not things like old boyfriends.
Now, there's one part where it was so edited that I wondered why you even included it, where you said there was a thing about when people tell you deep, dark, horrific secrets, what do you do? And you said, well, somebody told me a deep, dark, horrific secret, but then you don't even give the reader the slightest clue of what it's even about.
It was really too horrible to reveal, even to you, Mary Charlotte.
So, the book is called Gossip. What is gossip?
Oh, that was part of, that was part of my internal and then, you know, writerly debate when I wrote the essay about gossip. Because, as I say it, and you've probably had this experience too, which is to say, I would be completely stupid about human life if I hadn't listened to people talk. And by people, I mean women. If I hadn't been gossiping since I was 11 or 12 years old, what would I know? I would know nothing. And so, you know, gossip is free, it doesn't serve, you know, the media, it has no agenda. So in a way, it's this fantastic energy.
And it also, it goes just by nature to what is most juicy and interesting.
Absolutely. On the other hand, gossip is totally evil, right? I mean, it's about...
Can be.
About bad-mouthing people behind their back. It's about feeling good at other people's expenses. So I think there's a kind of a narrow road of gossip between sort of truth and something that might feel good emotionally, but that lacks integrity.
It's funny. I am, my evil twin, DJ Carlota, is a is a salsa DJ, Latin music DJ, and once tried to play a set of music that wasn't about love and romance. Huh. And there wasn't a whole lot in there. And as I was looking through the table of contents of your books, they're mostly about love and sex.
Definitely, particularly at the start, because that's the foremost thing, I think. Well, maybe that's the foremost thing that we feel ignorant about. That we also that
or that we think about in the first place.
Exactly. And that we want to know about. Although I've often thought that if I had paid as much attention to what people said about money as to what people say about sex, I would be rich today.
We're talking to Miriam Sagan. Her new book is called Gossip. It's a collection of personal essays with two little, what are they, Peruvian figures on the cover?
I think they're Guatemalan ladies. They're two little pottery figures.
With their hands over their mouths, looking very interested about what's being said. The first essay in the book is, I actually dog-eared the parts of the book where I laughed out loud, and there's quite a lot of dog ears. But the first book is called Beyond Love Potion Number 9, and it's about partly about your being a Jersey girl.
Absolutely. But you want to hear a little bit of it?
Yeah, let's hear a little bit of it.
All right.
Let's hear first about what it means to you to be a New Jersey girl.
Oh, it's a dreadful condition because I can't get rid of it. No matter where I live, I take the internal New Jersey girl with me. And I think of Jersey girls as being a little bit punky or tough when it comes to areas of romance. Bossy, opinionated, used to getting their own way. It's kind of a anti-romantic victim stance. I mean, Madame Bovary was not a Jersey girl.
Well, so what's wrong with that?
Well, I guess I'd like to have an option sometime to choose my mode of behavior, but I feel driven by the place I was raised. How does that sound?
All right, well, let's hear a bit of Beyond Love Potion Number 9.
Basically, this essay, it has a little bit about love magic in it. And, you know, you can try it or not, although people keep trying it and they tell me results, which aren't always perfect, but they're always of interest. And essentially, I was trying to sort of codify both ideas about how you get love that are kind of mechanical in the magical sense and also that are about attitude. I grew up in New Jersey, where women have strong beliefs about love. It was there that I learned the first rule of acquiring a boyfriend. You have to sincerely want one. The girls I grew up with were smart and mean and wore white lipstick. But for all their independence, they wanted, needed, and usually had that essential item, at least one boyfriend. And they did not accept boyfriend substitutes. Boyfriend substitutes have become far too common among women today. Women suffer under the illusion that they should spend years grieving or processing their last failed relationship. They erroneously think that learning to live alone or having a state-of-the-art sound system is as good as a boyfriend. Such belief systems will keep you single. Be honest. If you lost your apartment or job, you would not just sit around getting in touch with your feelings or processing the loss. You would take action and start reading the want ads. But first, you have to believe that action is necessary and desirable, so repeat your mantra. I want a boyfriend. I need a boyfriend. I will get a boyfriend. A few simple steps will help you in your search. It is useful to make a list of every boyfriend you have ever had and to note how you acquired him. Perhaps you stole him from your roommate or met him at Sudsomatic. Get a roommate. Wash the car. What worked once will work again. Place an ad. Implore everyone you know to fix you up. Remember, one woman's ex-husband is another woman's new boyfriend. Another rule of thumb in looking for a boyfriend is to realize you cannot have it all. The universe will not allow you a boyfriend who fulfills all of your criteria for the perfect man. In fact, the universe will allow you only three conditions or bottom lines in the boyfriend search. Bottom lines are essential, so choose carefully. You may require a boyfriend who is rich, cute, and well-read, but you also have to settle for short and a smoker. In other words, an endless list will get you nowhere. When one friend of mine put in her order for her next husband, she said, he must cook, be older than me, like plump women, help with my kids, be part Italian, good at driving in snow, and love movies. It did not surprise me when she did not find such a person. Finding your bottom lines is a good predictor for the boyfriend search. Remember, you can't have it all, you don't deserve it all, and you won't get it all. Still, it is of no use to be overly modest. Bottom lines should not be too pathetic. Your goals for a boyfriend should not look like this. One, he should not be a pathological liar. Two, he should have a valid driver's license. 3, he should have no felony convictions. This minimalist approach does not usually result in a boyfriend either. Figure out your own bottom lines by asking yourself, what can I absolutely not live without? Unfortunately, meeting your bottom lines does not guarantee that your relationship will be a perfect or even an enduring one, but without bottom lines, no relationship stands a chance. They are the bare minimum. Repeat your mantra, I want a boyfriend. Gently mull until you have your 3 bottom lines. You are now ready for the all-important final step, the boyfriend ritual.
Miriam Sagan reading from her book, Gossip. Now, hang on. Are we not going to find out what some of these rituals are?
Yes, indeed, we are. Do you want to hear them now, or do you want to discuss them idly first?
Let's discuss them idly first. Did you ever actually do any of these rituals?
Yes. I did the ritual that comes next, which is actually the important ritual. I just put in other people's rituals just to give you a little, background. But the one that I did, which is about drawing your love, is something I did.
Drawing, as in drawing and painting?
No, as in drawing on the
magnetically.
Magnetically woo-woo drawing. Basically, I got a husband that way. And
ladies, perk up your ears.
Although there's some provisos, because I was told when it was taught to me, this is accurate, that it could just bring random lust.
Pure lust. Who wants that?
Yeah, oh, bummer, right.
So what's the ritual?
Well,
you want to read it?
You want to read it?
Yeah,
I can actually synthesize it, but okay. It might... Well, I'll tell you a little bit about it, and then I'll read it.
Okay.
Basically, what you need to do is you need to get yourself a candle, a white candle. And
it has to be white.
It definitely should be white. And don't get something that will take all day to burn, like a super plumber's candle. And you need to write on it. And I'll tell you what you need to write on it. And it says here, it suggested you use a rose thorn. But again, that's not absolutely imperative. Let's see. Love rituals and potions are nothing new. In fact, ever since Eve offered Adam that apple, women have been dabbling in a bit of kitchen magic, concocting something that will draw or keep or get rid of love. And here's your ritual. I was initiated into these ancient mysteries quite by accident many years ago when I lived in a big communal house in San Francisco. One of my male roommates had just broken up with his girlfriend, who had actually left him because she was now blissfully, passionately in love with her boss, a woman. The ex-girlfriend called him about returning some books and clothes, but I answered the phone. Miriam, she whispered excitedly, I've discovered this fantastic love ritual. Do it, and you'll fall in love. So here it is. Take a candle, write on it 3 times with a rose thorn, all my loves come to me. I'll say that one more time so that you can write it down. All my loves come to me, and burn it down. It works. You have to try it, she said. I was quite dubious, but she insisted. The only problem is, she added in a warning tone, is that sometimes it just draws raw lust first. You have to be careful to distinguish between love and lust, and that is something that even a ritual cannot help you with. Of course, I couldn't resist trying this love ritual. I didn't have a handy rose thorn, so I used a Bic pen instead. In a matter of weeks, all of my old sweeties had appeared back on the scene and were chasing me madly. This must have been the lust part. But sure enough, in a few months, I was in love, and a year later, I was married.
Now, do you attribute that to the Bic pen and the candle and all that?
Well, yes, in a way I do, because I think, I think that what torments us a lot in the realm of love is a feeling of conflict. Like, I remember when I was a teenager thinking, it's okay for me to want things, but it's not okay for me to need them. Need is like, it's just great. It gets disgusting.
Right.
And I think as you get older, at least as I got older, is realizing that need is a motivational force and an impersonal force, something you can't really control. So I do think that that it's a rare person who says, I need a boyfriend, I want a boyfriend, I must get a boyfriend, that we have more conflict about that trajectory. And that,
yeah, but that's, isn't that a sort of a post-feminist thing? In the 1950s, how many ladies were conflicted about that?
That's a very good point. I don't know. You think it's a post-feminist thing?
I don't know.
Or maybe...
It has to be.
You know what I think it is, though? I think feminism released the natural ambivalence that people have.
Oh.
I think culture can put pressure on you so that you appear to want only one thing when really you don't.
That's a very good point.
And then when you're free to be yourself, then you're in trouble because then you have conflicting needs.
We're talking to the very wise Miriam Sagan. Now, there are some other hilarious essays in this, and one of them, following the Love Rituals essay, is about flirtation, which is hilarious, especially since you taught your little daughter to flirt.
Yes, I did. I think it's very... I would teach you to flirt, but I don't think that you need it. I think it's a very important thing as a hobby, is to be able to flirt.
Now, and you said if you don't know how to do it, you practice on babies.
Yes.
That just cracked me up. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think babies are the origin of flirting. Because if you notice babies, like if the baby's not yours, you know, the baby's in a restaurant and you sort of want the baby's attention. If you pay a lot of attention to the baby will scream in terror, you know, because you're just this stranger. But if you do a little peekaboo with the baby, you stick your nose around the corner of the booth and then you stick your nose back, coming and going, the baby is fascinated by you. And I have to say that babies grow up to be grown-ups, and that I think this off-on behavior is very attractive to the human psyche, but that babies don't know how to hide their attraction to it. They're easily seduced.
Very interesting. And your daughter, when she was in junior high, or whatever it's called now, middle school, you found her and her friend combing sparkles through their hair, and you said, now that's not going to work as well as flirting.
Exactly. Well, and I do think that's in generally that I think people of both sexes, you know, whatever situation they're in, tend to think that making themselves attractive is going to be what draws love. And there's some truth in that, but I actually think that, well, first of all, that's, you know, attraction.
It's the candle.
It's the candle, right? But attraction is also limited by time and space. I mean, which is to say you have a limited control over it. But flirting you have infinite control over. And I think that people love to have attention paid to them.
So there's other, there's a few other actual themes in this book besides love and sex, although we will probably come back to those sometime in this conversation. But one of them is a hilarious essay called The H-Chip. What does the H stand for?
Oh, I'm glad you liked it. The H-Chip is something my sister Susanna invented because her husband is a terrible hypochondriac, as am I. And we both were spending hours on the web, you know, Googling Berry Berry, basically. And she was like, I'm going to install an H-chip, like we like parental controls. It doesn't exist, although I wish it did, where you would not be able to get to health sites or to see if you might be the only person you know who has avian flu, for example, right? You would not be able to get in. And it would serve as a sort of a stop against an obsession.
It's having known you, Miriam, for 13 or 14 years.
At least, Mary Charlotte.
I believe that we met in the spring of 1994.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And you are probably the most sensible person I've ever known in my whole life. How can you be a hypochondriac?
Well, maybe my being the most sensible person you've known, maybe is that a low standard? Maybe have you known a lot of very creative, artsy people?
I know lots of people.
I have a reputation for being sensible, but I think that it might be that I'm just sometimes 5% more sensible than is common about certain things, and it doesn't translate to where I'm not sensible, and I do think hypochondria is a kind of, you know, it's a kind of craziness.
It's a kind of, indeed it is. How does it manifest?
Well, you know, as I say in the essay, it manifested in my having this Peace Corps manual called What There Is to Do and There Is No Doctor, and my looking at things like snake bite and scorpion bite and the diseases I obviously never had, just to kind of be prepared. You might almost say that it's
a Boy Scout thing?
It's a Boy Scout thing, or it's an overcompensation for being sensible. It's like, well, what if I was in the wild where I never go, you know, and I was bitten by some kind of snake that doesn't live at this altitude? You know, what would I do?
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, you know, one thing is being prepared, but another thing is thinking that you actually have Ebola or something.
Right, and I think even worse than thinking you have Ebola is thinking that you are a doctor if you are not, which is also in the essay.
Ah, yes.
It's kind of a, you know, scientist manqué approach, which is, I sort of love disease, and I love diagnosis.
Well, you get, I mean, I've done this myself. You have the symptoms, and you Google them, and then you put together what you must have or what three things you could possibly have.
Exactly. And I did that for my cat, and I was totally wrong.
You were dead wrong.
I was completely wrong. It was good. I took her to the vet.
Very interesting. There is an interesting essay that I thought really demonstrates a generation gap, and that is about heroines. You were talking about your daughter coming up with her list of heroines or her little pantheon of female people she had in her mind versus your own.
And also, an incredible connection, because the sort of the main theme in that essay is about Eleanor Roosevelt.
That's right.
Who, you know, my grandmother, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt wasn't next to God. I mean, she was better than God. You know, she was it for women in the 30s and the 40s. And my daughter discovered her when we went to Washington, D.C. and got a book about her. So I think in a way there's definitely going to be generation gap in terms of heroines. But also what fascinated me was how certain heroines endured. I mean, like Anne of Green Gables and Little Women, how I would have thought, you know, if we had been talking about it, well, who would care about these rather, sort of Pollyanna-type heroines in today's, you know, literature of the problem family and all of that.
Well, and Anne of Green Gables is a great example of what you were talking about before, which is the ambivalence that comes up in the modern world. Anne of Green Gables was absolutely a fabulous, independent, imaginative character until she finally hunkered down with her stupid boyfriend.
And she
became boring and had lots of children. And you couldn't even, they were unreadable. But the early ones were great.
Yes, that's a really good point. I mean, the difference sort of between girl and wife, you know, in the 19th century, in terms of its vitality, is pretty profound in terms of literature. But also, you know, Anne of Green Gables is an orphan, and does anybody ever worry about this? No. Does she ever have therapy? No. Does she ever have to deal with her issues? No.
No, she just runs around having, what is it, she calls it scope for imagination.
Ah, wow. Yeah.
We're talking to Miriam Sagan. When you are writing a personal essay under deadline for a magazine, do you have trouble ever coming up with material?
Well, yes. I mean, I keep a little notebook, and I'll sometimes wander around the house, or if I'm on a long car trip with my husband, Rich, I'll say, okay, what are my ideas? Which means I don't have any. I mean, which means I'm looking for somebody else to give me those ideas. And it's, I don't have sort of a panic feeling under deadline, because I won't be under deadline usually unless I've already sold the idea in a kind of, you know, germ form, a short form, which is good. But no, like right now, I only have a glimmering of what I'm going to write about next. And I'm often sort of desperately scouring. I mean, like walking around the house to see if there's anything that triggers my mind.
Does walking around the house work?
It does. And actually, to asking everybody in the family, like, what are we thinking about? Or what are we worrying about? That actually does help, yeah.
There's a wonderful essay in here, and I'm going to try to find it because I would like you to read from it. It's about time. It's on page 55, and it's called Time is on My Side. And I actually learned something from that essay. I've learned a number of things, but would you like to read, if it's not too long, maybe the whole thing or part of it?
Yeah, you know, I really would, because I think in a way that it's actually, in a way for me, the basic essay in the book, and I'm glad you pointed to it, because it's confession and how-to on a large scale. And essentially it says that everyone I know complains about not having enough time. My sister Susanna likes to fantasize about what she would do if she had another 2 hours a day. Exercise more, read, garden. What would you do, she asks. I have all the time I need, I say. Oddly, this isn't really a socially acceptable answer among my friends and family, a group of hard-working women, many of whom are moms. Time stress is a reality of our lives, but also something we boast about, or at least enjoy complaining about. I really do have enough time. That's because I subscribe to the words I once heard a Zen master say, time is me and you. Time is in my body, heart, beating more slowly than that of my cats or guinea pigs, human time. I have time for two simple reasons. One, I do not watch television, and two, I have no work ethic.
I thought that was hilarious that you have no work ethic, because you have published, what, 25 books at this point in your life?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I don't work, but part of what I say in the essay is that I don't ever pretend to work. The same sister who was worrying about this, when she went on maternity leave, she realized she was doing an 8-hour a day job in about 4.5 hours at home. She wasn't drinking coffee. She wasn't buying things from catalogs. And, I mean, she was an executive director. It wasn't like she was just, you know, fooling around. But I do think that a lot of what drives us is this feeling that we should look busy, that we should look like we're really hustling, like we're really on top of things. And I, you know, I'm just famous for, like, basically, like, lying down with a, you know, cool cloth over my eyes. Whenever. During the day.
Well, you sleep 9 hours a night. You also take naps during the day.
I'm very well rested.
And you are, what, the most productive person I know, or one of them?
Well, you know, I wouldn't say I want to tout this system. I mean, I say later on in the essay, you know, you could follow this, but I feel very sure that you will not. And I don't think everybody's like this. I mean, I think I'm a sprinter by nature. Like, it's easy for me to concentrate and easy for me to get exhausted. So I've kind of structured a life that works with the way I work in terms of energy. And I think a lot of people don't have that option or are sort of afraid to not look like the status quo.
Very interesting. The there's one part where it said, how to get started, some tips on how to rest up. And then it has categories like equipment. What is the equipment, a couch?
Yeah, equipment is a couch or a pillow or something like that.
Nap with authority. Find your power nap spot. I have to say, I sort of related to this because having to get up at the extreme crack of dawn in order to be here with you, ladies and gentlemen, with you, Miriam, it's just ridiculously too early for my little biorhythms. And afterwards, I go home. And I spend some quality couch time with my three dogs.
It's a very good, see? Yeah.
Often not quite as awake.
Mm-hmm. So you're already on the system to some extent. And you look very good.
Thank you, Miriam. So we're talking to Miriam Sagan. There are some serious essays in this book, and one of them is, there's actually a number of them about being a widow.
Yes.
And about the death when he was only 36 years old of your husband. What are some things that you think people need to know about how to treat widows, or for that matter, widowers?
Well, you know, it's interesting because after I wrote that essay, you know, life doesn't stand still. And my second mother-in-law died, leaving my father-in-law widowed. And I suddenly saw again, you know, what's it like to be in such an altered state in a social context? And really, I guess my main point in that, and something that I still hold with and try to follow myself, is do something, say something. We can be very inhibited about death, I think, and very frightened that you're going to upset or hurt the person. And, like, get over that. That person is already more upset than they've ever been. And you really can't, you can't create that upset. But people say, oh, I didn't want to remind you that your husband was dead. I mean, you know, come on.
Yeah, so they talk about other things.
Exactly.
And you talked about how important it was to actually talk about the person who's died.
Talk about the person, because that's what the bereaved person really needs to hear. And it might be even really what you need to say. Sort of acknowledge the situation and don't act like you, and this is the hardest thing, you can't solve it. And that's why I think that's why people are so inhibited, is we're used to problem solving. We're used to taking care of other people. This is a situation where you just, it's really important that you be there, so you just need to hang out.
Another thing that you said was that people were very practical, and some of the people who helped you most during your time of grief were people who did things like gardening, carpool, and bringing food.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's also because I was a single mom at that point, but also because I think when you're bereaved, you lose, it's not just that you're you know, distraught and disorganized. I think you lose contact with the world in a way. And you lose contact with the caretaking aspects that you might normally have taken care of your environment. It's like a kind of depression or sorrow. And if somebody else can do that for you, they've been a little bit of a midwife back.
I actually experienced that a while back. Somebody broke up with me, and my good friend's funeral was on the same day.
Oh, wow.
And I couldn't find Old Pecos Trail.
Right. I know exactly what you mean. Like, well, basically, Old Pecos Trail was temporarily gone. And in a way, you know, if you could get somebody to drive you in that situation, somebody who still knows where Old Pecos Trail is, it's grounding.
There's also an essay about the grieving process of children, which, of course, your daughter had to go through.
And that was the first really the first or the second essay that I wrote. It was that experience of bereavement that got me into the personal essays. First of all, editors were interested in it, and it was very hot and lively for me, and also incredibly unknown. What did I know about this? Like, zero. And then I began to understand it, and that was how I got into the personal essays. And again, you know, the advice I give grown-ups, you know, to sort of just hang out with a bereaved person was very hard to follow as a mother to a child, because you're really used to fixing things when you're the mom. And
when you say hang out with it, you don't necessarily mean be in the same room all the time.
I guess I mean understand that something very intense and, as you say, long-lived is going on that you can only acknowledge, you can't cure. And again, that's difficult because we're just used to, you know, making things okay for our kids.
I remember that process in your life, and I remember being very struck by your saying once that you let your daughter be in her room, make noises, do things, and just you let it go. And I thought that's something that probably my own mother would never have done.
Well, you know, I was taking my cue from her, which is if she wanted me, she could have me. But she also wanted some privacy, which I understood. Being in the same spot, I think, you know, it led to a funny kind of equality between us. Like, there was I had a certain respect for her that I still retain, because I wasn't in charge of her, you know? Unusual.
Unusual indeed. We're talking to Miriam Sagan. She's going to be reading from her new book, Gossip, which is a collection of personal essays, tonight at Collected Works Bookstore at 5:30 in the evening. And this is on San Francisco Street in downtown Santa Fe, across the street from the Lenzic. There's also a kind of nice essay on taking advice.
Yes. You know, I obviously like to give advice.
But You don't say.
Yeah, really. But I've often been a little hapless and needed advice, and I realized that sometimes I was getting prime advice and that I was ignoring it. And I think we're surrounded by other people's, expertise and really wisdom. And it was hard for me to differentiate between being, like, butted into and bossed around, like my immediate family in New Jersey would have, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, you know, you call that address sort of attitude. And the fact that people really did know something that I should pay attention to. So I wrote the essay for myself in a way to tell myself, pay attention to the fact that you're surrounded by intelligent, compassionate women who are telling you something you ought to do.
No, you say women.
Yeah, well, that kind of goes back to the gossip, which is, the book has really got like a little cabal of people in it, a little chorus.
Yeah.
And they show up. They show up talking about each other behind each other's backs, and then they show up giving advice as well. So I sort of think of them as the same voice.
It was interesting to me to read that essay because it made me think about the difference between solicited and unsolicited advice. Unsolicited advice can be really annoying, but it can also change the course of your life.
That's interesting. It's much harder to take unsolicited advice. I mean, it would have to be brilliant, right?
Well, I do a lot of reading for this show, and there's sometimes biographies or autobiographies of people in which they say, and then somebody said to me, why don't you pick up a camera?
Right, and the rest is history.
The rest is history. But there are so many, I mean, I don't know how you would go about compiling this, but there are so many people whose life direction has been changed by somebody saying, why don't you do this?
Except, you know, I sort of think that, don't you think people tell you that kind of thing all day long? And that when you finally follow it, it's because it lined up with something.
Yes.
And that's what you remember.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, that's true. It may be that there's 40 of those a day, and you choose one of them a lifetime, and then you think it was good advice.
Or also, and also I think you are right, though, you know, somebody might really be giving you something. They might really understand you. They might really know what you should do.
So what's your advice to people about taking advice?
My advice is to first of all, to see if you asked for it. And I think, you know, I think we have a bad habit of asking for advice and then disregarding it. Because really, we're not asking for advice. We're really kind of complaining. And then I would say, you know, double check it along your gut. Does this feel like you? And if it does, take a chance. Yeah.
You end the book, I think it's the last essay, with, or the next to last essay, with a piece called Credo. Credo.
Oh, about belief.
About
yes.
belief. Which is an interesting, I mean, there's a, a theme of self-help throughout the book, and I don't do self-help books on this program in general, and luckily this is sufficiently literary not to fall into that category. But there is this interesting exercise that you have done yourself and that anybody could do, which is to write the word "I believe" and then see what comes out after it. And you've got a whole set of beliefs in here.
Well, you know, this comes from Margot Chavez, the writer in Las Cruces, and I got it, you know, sort of in a lineage from her. From
Denise
her sister.
Chavez.
It comes from Denise, and I got it from Margot.
Uh-huh.
So I got it from her sister. And it obviously comes from the, you know, a kind of liturgy, "I believe, I believe, I believe." And here's my last piece of advice, which is I definitely think it's a great idea to do something like this, because it lets you find out what's important to you, even if it's a little silly or loose. Like, for example, I say, "I believe that Beatles songs have messages directly for me," which seems a little paranoid, and yet I...
A little narcissistic?
Maybe, or, you know, right, whatever that is, but confessing it was good for me. And
read them aloud, if you don't mind, start at the beginning.
Okay. "I believe the world is neither good nor evil, but a mix, the same for human nature. I believe it is better to sit than stand for a living, which is why I'm a community college teacher and encourage upward mobility. I believe in strictly budgeting my money. I believe that God responds more to deeds than prayers, or that deeds are the greatest prayer. I believe that the life of the mind is a good distraction from suffering. I believe in eating fruits and vegetables. I believe in not wearing a bra. I believe in baseball. I believe it is fine to be fat. I believe the end of the world is not coming anytime soon. I'm not so sure about that now, but at the time, that was part of my belief. I believe I can handle many kinds of emergencies. I believe that Beatles songs have messages directly for me. I believe I can currently know nothing about life after death. I believe in keeping my passport current. I believe in the mystical power of calendars and seasons. I believe it is good to eat garlic. I believe there is a vast energy beyond me that can aid me if I can tap into it. I believe I will die. I believe in rock and roll."
Miriam Sagan, I believe that this is a wonderful book. It's called Gossip, and thank you for being here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to see you.
And Miriam Sagan will be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 5:30, and that's right across from the Lenzic Theater in downtown Santa Fe. We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. I'd like now to welcome, joining us by telephone, Nancy Hopkins Riley. She is the author of a new book, Georgia O'Keeffe, A Private Friendship, Part 1, Walking the Sun Prairie Land. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Nice to be here this morning.
Now, A Private Friendship, what does that mean? Explain that title.
Well, of all the books that have been written about Georgia O'Keeffe, there are a few that have been written by people that actually know her, and I was privileged to spend a lot of my childhood at my aunt and uncle's ranch, Rancho de Abiquiu, which was across the river from the Chama River, from George's Abiquiu home. So she was our friend, and we visited in her home, and she visited in our home, and that's how I was acquainted with her.
Did you know her very well?
Not real, real well, but I met her when I was a teenager, so, you know, I wasn't probably too interested in art and all those things that went along with Georgia, but I have collected stories from my family and the memorabilia, and in the process I found 19 letters that my uncle had saved, and also about 15 little snapshots of a family gathering and everything, so I've been acquainted with her, you know, through all of that.
Now, you are an artist yourself, is that correct?
Well, I've done outdoor color portrait work, and I've retired from that, and that seemed to have led to writing. So I've used what I learned in photography, you know, to see color and shapes and forms, and to put that into writing, which is possibly just another way to see. So I have retired from the photography. It just got rather strenuous, so I turned my attention to writing. I'm self-taught. I have a degree from SMU in a business in retail merchandising, so I'm quite a distance from being a creative writer from college.
You, at the beginning of the book, talk about Georgia O'Keeffe's life. And, of course, one of the things that's most striking about her life is that she was such a very independent woman in a time where this was far from the norm. How did she get that way?
Well, I think she had some tremendous role models in her life. Her mother, although she said she didn't get along real well with her mother, but she must have absorbed her mother's independence. She had an aunt who was very independent, and she also had one of her first art teachers was a woman named Sarah Mann in Sun Prairie. And so I think she had a lot of role models during that time.
Who were her early teachers, both men and women, who inspired her to become an artist?
Well, she studied at the Art Institute of Chicago, and then she studied with the Art Students League in New York, and John Vanderpoel was one of them, and also William Merritt Chase was one of her teachers, and I think they greatly influenced her, and sometimes the influence was that she took another direction from what they were teaching, which is very obvious, because when she found Canyon, Texas, and all the beautiful colors in Canyon, and then found all of the beautiful colors north of Santa Fe at the Ghost Ranch areas, this is when she really found what I would call her sense of place. And she said she could always exist as long as there was a horizon and color.
And it's interesting that she really didn't thrive in places that were terribly green and full of lush trees.
No, she really liked the color. And she just devoted. And I think... so many people have said that she was a loner. I didn't, in my research, I found that she had a tremendous amount of friends, and she became a loner and independent when she got focused on her art. And then when she was completely focused on what she was doing in the art world, then she kind of set her friendships aside for the time being, but then she always recovered them. And so I found that she was really not a loner.
How did Georgia O'Keeffe meet Alfred Stieglitz, whom she married?
Well, about 1908, there was an exhibition that he was doing on Auguste Rodin, and she was in school there in New York, and all of her students gathered around and went to see the exhibition, and that's where she first encountered Alfred Stieglitz at his art gallery.
I think one of the interesting contrast that you draw in this book is the contrast between Alfred Stieglitz's first wife and Georgia O'Keeffe.
Yes, there's obviously quite a difference. Stieglitz always wanted to do what he called the best portrait of a person would be from birth to death, and his wife, Emma, would not agree to that, and so that was a point of friction. And so when Georgia and Alfred met, it wasn't too long after that he began a series of pictures on Georgia and eventually turned into some nude photographs, which he put in an exhibition. And so by the time Georgia had her first art exhibition, she was already a celebrity from the nude exhibition that he had of her photographs. So I thought that was kind of an interesting way to promote someone.
And also a little bit of an ambivalent position to be in if you were that woman, you were the artist.
Yes, and they divorced in, I think, 1924, and Georgia and Alfred married shortly after that.
We're talking to Nancy Hopkins Riley. Her book is called Georgia O'Keeffe, A Private Friendship, Walking the Sun Prairie Land. She will be in Santa Fe on Friday, the 9th of November at 5:30 at the Palace of the Governors Fray Angelico Chavez History Library on Washington Avenue right here in Santa Fe. Tell us more about the subtitle, Walking the Sun Prairie Land.
Well, I heard Shelby Heron speak one time, and she is a winner of several literary awards, and she suggested that you write of what you know and to walk the land. And I had walked the land in Abiquiu as a child, so I just started walking the land for this part of the book, which took me to Canyon, Texas. Excuse me, took me to Sun Prairie and Amarillo. And I actually described these places for you the many people that ride of Georgia just tell you the black place is so many miles northwest of Abiquiu, but I tell you how to get there, what to do when you get there. I take you through the park at the canyon, the Paladura Canyon. I take you through Amarillo, where she lives. So anyone that's really interested in Georgia O'Keeffe can actually go to these places, and you can envision what she saw.
And so it's actually kind of a Georgia O'Keeffe fan's guidebook.
Yes. It will cover lots of places that she was and where she painted. And I found that where she stood was always where she painted. It's an obvious statement, but she painted wherever she was. You can almost follow her chronology by where she traveled.
So the book is called Part 1. Do you have a Part 2 in mind?
Yes, Part 2. Actually, the book became too long, and my publisher, Jim Smith at Sunstone Press, suggested I make 2 volumes. So Part 2 covers the time from when my family meets her in 1946 to her death in 1986. So Part 1 is the part before I meet her, and then Part 2 is after we meet her, and it is walking the Abiquiu and Ghost Ranch land.
And that's the part that has family, your family memorabilia and so on.
Yes, that will be all of my family stories and photographs and what have you. It just simply got too long, and Jim suggested I break it into 2 parts, which I thought was a real good idea.
Well, Nancy Hopkins Riley, thank you for speaking with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it, and hopefully I'll see you when I come on the 9th.
And Nancy Hopkins Riley will be in Santa Fe on the 9th at 5:30, 120 Washington Avenue, Fray Angelico Chavez Library, and for more information, 476-5090. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, which is my little website where you can listen to the show any time of day or night, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. People have said to me recently, what does podcasting mean? It doesn't mean anything. It just means you can go listen to the show by clicking on the show, either the day's show or the or past programs. Let's see. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Thanks to stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features Artist of the Month Shorty Rogers. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow we will be talking with Rob DeWalt, who's sitting in for Robert Knott, and we will be speaking about Diego Rivera and the labor movement in Detroit and much more. So keep your dial tuned to KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station. Hasta la vista. Ciao.